Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome again to The Hobcast. It's a special edition. It's a midweek edition.
We never do this in the middle of the week.
No, we never. We don't. We don't do many things in the middle of the week. But it is show number 81. And the reason it's in the middle of the week is that this is a pre-Harrogate special.
It is. We have a very special interview. We do.
We're speaking to Vaseem Khan, who is one of the best crime writers in the country, as evidenced by the fact that he is on the shortlist for this year's Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year Award, which will be awarded the day after this podcast is published.
Yeah, tomorrow. And by the time we see him in the flesh, he'll know whether he's won or not.
Exactly. So it was great to speak to him. Now, Vaseem is also known for his partnership with Abhir Mukherjee on their wonderful podcast, The Red Hot Chili Writers.
Which I highly recommend because it's very funny.
It is really funny. And he's also a leading light in the Crime Writers Association. So many things to talk about with Vaseem, and he'll be along a little later. In fact, we're going to keep the top of the programme tight.
He keeps telling me this.
It never happens.
I'll believe it when I see it. We haven't said we should say who we are.
Oh, yeah, we'll do all that now. Okay. Well, my name is Adrian Hobart.
And my name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hoback Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Crime.
Thrillers.
Mystery.
And the other one, suspense. And we, in this podcast, usually reflect on our lives and also, you know, the facts and figures and the difficulties of running a business in the current climate. And we also have our star interview. So we've already mentioned who we got on the programme. We also deal with some news. What have you found?
Well, we've only got 2 days to go on. And actually, there was quite a lot of things in the 2 days. The first thing was a news item about Amazon, who seem to be managing to escape paying corporation tax.
Yes, again.
So, but their argument is, but look what we've done for the UK economy. We've built so many new buildings for, you know, the business, operating the business from. We've created jobs and we've generated lots of, you know, spending and income and blah-de-blah-de-blah.
Well, it is the nature of these global companies is that they can base themselves in a tax regime where they don't have to pay corporation tax or much less. So often they're based, currently Google, I think, and Amazon have their European operations based in Dublin, where the tax regime is lower. But basically, yeah, I mean, they generate billions in sales in the UK and don't really, you know, pay much back into the exchequer. Of course, people who are employed by them are paying taxes.
That's their argument. They're saying we're paying all above board on the you know, national insurance and income tax.
Yeah,
and
that's just doesn't wash. I think there's a big move to change all that. But this is what big global companies do. And, you know, it's been a fact of life for years now. But all the big digital companies exploit this loophole.
They do. I mean, you can understand it in a way. Who wouldn't want to save money where they can, whether you're one person or a massive company?
Mm.
It's human nature.
Well, I mean, it's efficient tax-wise from the point of view of the accountants and the business. I can understand that. But at the same time, morally, is it right? And that's the real question. So, no surprise there, I'm afraid. That's been the case for years. And our next story is...
It's a continuation of what we've been talking about for the last few weeks. Lack of funding, having an impact on the creative arts and particularly prizes.
Yes.
So these prizes...
We've mentioned so far the Costa.
Yeah.
Which used to be known as the Whitbread. So that's gone. The Blue Peter Award for Children's Literature has gone.
There's also another one which we must have missed, was the Guardian First Book Awards. That's gone as well.
Oh, really? I didn't notice that. Okay.
No,
so,
I didn't notice
so
that.
So that's three. Now, well, what else is on the block?
So there's two more that are in jeopardy. The Sunday Times Short Story Award. I mean, you might say, well, it's just Short Story Award, but actually a lot of writers start off their career writing short stories before they embark on a book, a full book.
Yes.
So it's a very important
award. It's a good
award.
Calling card. Particularly if you've won that thing, you're going to find an agent, probably.
So that's in danger of being discontinued. It's, you know, it still exists, but there's mm-hmm. jeopardy. So there's a warning out there. And then the Desmond Elliott Prize, which I confess I haven't heard of, but they are going to have to pause for a year because they haven't secured the funding for the prize money. So, you know.
Well, that's the nature of a lot of these things. I mean, we were talking about festivals last week as well. And when you talk to festival organisers, they always say, yeah, we're intending to run it as long as we can get the funding. And so, you know, it's not possible really to commit to a venue or to signing up a list of people based purely on ticket sales. It does rely on money from the Arts Council or other funding bodies. So, I mean, you could make the argument, and many people do, that the arts needs to stand on its own 2 feet. And, you know, that's just tough. In this current climate where you can't afford to feed people or heat their homes and all that sort of thing, the problems with book prizes or book festivals are minor. And I know that we would counter that argument, but at the same time, that is the argument that people would make.
Is that, okay, by you saying that, that means that the government are paying the money that they have to help people with their heating bills? And
no, they're not.
So they're not doing...
No, well, that's the zero-sum game here, isn't it? The fact is that, to a large extent, they're turning their backs on the problems of ordinary people. But in a climate when people are struggling, it's very easy to make the argument why should we be worried about British culture being, you know, eroded and not being funded in those circumstances? Even though the people making that argument often won't have any concern for the people who are suffering. So it's an argument levelled at all sorts of organisations that perhaps don't make things in the sense of, you know, widgets, organisations that add to our cultural good. It's very hard to put a financial, justification on that.
Okay, my argument is then, if we don't have any culture or creativity, the NHS is going to be more expensive. Because of mental health.
Yes. No, I mean, there are lots of things you could do that would actually, if you committed money to helping mental health, for instance, properly, or indeed physical health properly, you would actually reduce the cost to a significant degree of frontline services in the NHS. But that's not how it works.
No, I know that's not how it works. And I know it's never as simple as it sounds when you put it out like that. It never is. So
no, exactly. People would prefer to just, you know, focus on the frontline stuff.
Yeah. It's a very British thing, actually.
Yeah, it is.
Short-termism.
Well, we're a nation of it. And we didn't used to be, but we are nowadays. And
Margaret Thatcher's fault. Just saying.
You know, other prime ministers are available to blame for all this. But this, you know, it is a fact that it has changed. The sort of that dynamic has changed considerably since World War II, and certainly in the last 30, 40 years. So anyway, we've delved into politics there. I don't know how we got there.
I think that you could blame me this time rather than yourself.
I haven't taken it down the rabbit hole, but, you know, it is an interesting time watching all things politics. And I was watching or listening to Prime Minister's questions earlier today, which was Boris's last. And, you know, the bluster and the sort of look at what we've achieved. And then it's, you know, really doesn't stand up to any scrutiny whatsoever, which is what the Labour Party were doing, basically saying, well, you know, the economy's a wreck. You can't say anything other. And actually, most of the Tory Party leadership candidates have been saying much the same thing. It is a wreck, even though they've been promising tax cuts with money we don't have. So
I have a lighter story to move us away from politics. So a lovely man who I met about a year ago, a very tall, lovely man who owns a Hoback mug, is donating 1,000 of his books for free to UK libraries.
It's your paramour, Richard Osman.
It is.
And you're stalking him, basically.
Well, is he not going to... He's not going to be at Harrogate this year,
is he? No, he's not. No, no, no. No, they haven't invited him this time.
So his book, the first one, thingy, what's it? What's it called again?
Thursday Murder Club.
Thursday Murder Club is the most lended book at the library.
Most lent.
Most lended. Lent. Most lent book in 2021. So it's obviously a demand for it for libraries. So he saw this and thought, you know, he should help people read his book, access his book, and he's doing it. So good on him.
1,000 copies.
Yes.
It's about a grand's worth of books, if you think about it, for someone with a big print run like him.
Yeah, the hardbacks aren't... Well, oh, I don't
hardbacks.
Know, actually. They could
well,
be,
I don't know.
I don't know.
If they were paper, okay. Well,
libraries look, tend to be hardbacks, it's a
few,
don't they?
It's a few grand at most. Anyway, yeah. Well, thank you very much, Richard. I'm sure the people will appreciate that. Well, what else have we got to say? Well, we're looking forward to Harrogate. We'll talk about that after the interview. It's a bonkers event, really, in many ways, because everywhere you look are some of the greatest writers in the English language in the world who happen to be focused on crime. And there are lots and lots of friends of Hoback who are going to be there and members of Hoback and all sorts of things. So it's going to be as... If the last one was anything to go by, we'll be knackered by 9:30 and we'll be tucked in bed. But we're not doing the panel events this time. We're just going to mingle and
yes.
speak to and build contacts and do that sort of thing and spread the message.
Just be. We're just going
to
be.
And record podcasts as well and speak to as many great authors as we can manage.
So and we're going to ask someone the winning random question from Wendy.
Yes. Wendy.
A lady
yes.
called Wendy, who's Wendy Collins, she's called. No relation. I don't know any Wendy's in my family. She came up with the most... imaginative random question for us to ask at Harrogate. So I don't know who's going to get the question yet, but one of our podcasts, they will get Wendy's
Val
question.
Val McDermott is going to get this one. We'll see. That's if I actually pluck up the courage to ask her for an interview. We'll see if that happens as well. But let's get into our big interview for this edition of the Hobcast, which is, of course, with Vasim Khan. And he has two major crime series out, one set in the current day India, the Baby Ganesh investigation series. And then another series which has done extremely well and is nominated, the first book of which is nominated for this year's Theakston's Award. And that's set in 1950s India, just after partition and all the other issues that spun out of that. So a great historical work. That's the Malabar House series. So we're looking forward to speaking. Well, we spoke about that. We spoke about many, many things.
Oh, we did.
We covered
lots
all
of
sorts of topics. It was a lot of fun as well. So let's hear from the man himself before I make any more mistakes about what his books are called. Here is, I think it's Marsabar actually, rather than Malabar. It is Vasim Khan. Well, it's a great honour to have on the Hobcast Book Show, Vasim Khan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, the honour is all mine, people.
And I'm sorry we didn't have a limo to take you to your home. From your home.
I know, I did feel a bit let down by the fact that I wasn't picked up. But then again, if I had been picked up, you might have kidnapped me and held me to ransom and asked my missus to pay something to get me back.
Oh,
but that would have been a non-starter. She'd probably have said, keep me.
But we might have had a
can
crowd.
Can you cook, though? Because if you can cook, we'll keep you.
Do you like squishy boiled eggs?
That'll do. That's fine.
This is sounding suspiciously like domestic slavery, which has been in the news this week with Mo Farah. But anyway, let's move on. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, look, it's amazing to be speaking to you in a week where, you know, it's getting pretty bonkers for you, because a week after we speak to you, you'll be in Harrogate and up for the big one, the Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Writing Book of the Year. Fantastic.
Well, thank you. So Midnight at Malabar House, which is the first book in my 1950s Bombay-set historical crime series that, as you rightly say, is on the shortlist for Theakston's Crime Novel of the Year. How does it feel? It feels great to be in bed and snuggling up to the likes of Mick Herron and Ellie Griffiths and all the other wonderful authors who are nominated this year, but also all of those who've been shortlisted in previous years or won the damn thing. Look, I spent 23 years trying to get published without much luck. 7 different novels. I've been rejected by pretty much every agent in this country at some point. But over the last decade since I have been published and writing, it's come to me a lot later in life, which means that I'm quite mellow about these kind of things. I've won awards previously, Midnight at Malabar House won the CWA Historical Dagger. So I've experienced those highs. And now it's just a question of, for me, the reward is being able to write and know that there is at least one person out there reading these things.
Well, more than that, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it's your, we have a connection in the sense that one of our authors is assigned to the same agent, Ewan Thornycroft.
And he was also up for a dagger.
Mark Whiteman. So indeed, we bumped into each other at CWA Daggers, and of course, people listening to the show last week would have, or the week before last, I should say, will have heard. I grabbed a few words. Yeah, a little snippet.
This is actually your second appearance.
Which is amazing.
I'm wearing out my welcome.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that on me, but you now share that honour with Abir, who's been on twice as well. So, and that's another thing we'll talk about later.
Times too many, some might say.
Nonetheless, I mentioned when we bumped into each other just how impactful your penultimate blog, I suppose it is, the one where you described that journey and passed on your thoughts on how to be realistic about being an author trying to get published, and you know, those sort of pieces of advice about how tough the industry is, even though you're reaching the you're up there. Towards the top of the UK crime scene, it's still one never feels settled. Is that fair?
That is fair. I mean, it's nice the way you describe that, being at the peak or the top of the crime scene, but the peak of a mountain is usually where there's no oxygen and you die very quickly. I'm very realistic about things, and I try and pass that realism on to budding authors. We all hear sensational stories about the $1 million advance and the instant success, but the truth is that most people are overnight bestsellers, having already got 5 or 7 books in the drawer. So it was the same with me. I had 7 books in the drawer, and then I got a contract from my first series, the Baby Ganesh Agency series, beginning with The Unexpected Inheritance of Inspector Chopra, which was set in modern India, and that book became really successful, and it gave me the platform to carry on writing. But that couldn't have happened without the 2 decades of disappointment and heartbreak and continually picking myself up off the floor and starting a new book and always holding on to the fact that I'd always wanted to be a writer and never quite giving up, although you do get incredibly down, and that's a fact. And the point of that piece, which people can see on my website, vasimkhan.com, is simply to give other writers who are in that position, in the trenches, the idea that persistence sometimes does pay off.
Sometimes. Yeah, and that's there's no question you need that. That persistence is essential.
And believe in yourself as well. I think that's what you're saying, isn't it? That even when other people are saying that, or other people are rejecting you, you've got this belief in yourself and you think, eventually I'm going to do it.
Absolutely. And it's got to be married with something else, which and the nicest way I can put it is, don't be rubbish. the biggest hurdle to most new writers in terms of getting agents and publishers to look at their work is because the quality of writing, the quality of prose, is not good enough to be in a published novel. And when you're younger, or when you're new to the writing game, you don't have enough distance from your work to be able to assess that. And this happened to me at the age of 17. I was reading Terry Pratchett's wonderful Discworld series I discovered in my local library. And I thought, well, this looks bloody easy. I can do this. And so I wrote a novel, a comic, sci-fi fantasy, age 17. And I went to my parents and I said, you know what? I'm not going to university. I'm going to be a rich and famous writer. So you can imagine what Asian parents said to that particular assertion. Anyway, I sent it off to a few agents. It was roundly rejected because, of course, it was rubbish. And, you don't realize it. It was heartbreaking to realize, to come face to face with that at that point of time when you're young. But it was an important step on the road because I had completed a novel. And they say that starting a novel is the easiest thing in the world. Finishing one is the bloody hardest.
That's true. We are both people who have started novels and never finished them.
Stop. Why do you always, every week you remind me of this?
I know.
Every week. It's like, Oh, actually, to be fair,
you need to remind him with a big stick.
Well, it's kind of a bit like that. But then, you know, if you stick another novel that I've got to proof or, you know, record for audio or any of those other things, how am I going to finish my magnum opus?
Do you want to eat?
Okay, well, if you withdrew the two things I enjoy in life, which is watching sport and eating food.
You'd be very miserable.
As long as you're not watching politics at the moment, because it's like a, well, I'd say it's like a tank of piranhas. But
it
would,
is.
It would be an insult to piranhas, so I'm not going to say.
Well,
that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if I would love to put a David Attenborough voice on proceedings. You know, here the alpha male approaches the alpha female, the mordant species is, you know. Yeah. But it has fascinated me. In fact, it's been one of the things that's deflected me. And just to mention that we've said this a few times on the podcast, for our lucky listeners, at some point early next year you'll be able to read our diary of our entire year running the business. But there's been a lot of Boris entries from me.
Yeah, it's quite funny. So this diary, we write an entry every day, the view from Mars and the view from Venus on what it's like running Hoback. And his are always about politics.
Oh, so it's not Adrian Molish, you know, we're not going to get anecdotes.
No,
he's not measuring anything.
He's not measuring any anatomy. Yeah.
Okay, well, this is the nature of the podcast. We divert.
And by Pandora Braithwaite, then.
Well, I did go out with a sort of Pandora figure at one stage, honestly. Gwen, if you're listening, you're still my Pandora. But I went out with a girl who was a bit like Pandora at the age of 13 and three quarters. And the unfortunate thing is that book came out when I was 13 and a quarter. And it has, and certainly for 5 years, it was a shadow over my teenage years because everyone assumed.
Because you're called Adrian.
Because I was Adrian, you know, la la la. You know, it became one of my nicknames.
And you're a bit
here
geeky.
Comes Molly, you know, la 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 la. Have you measured your thingy?
Oh, God. Oh, God.
There was all those sort of factors. And to be fair, yeah, I think I probably did.
We're dredging up.
I'm sure you did.
We're dredging up teenage angst here.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I'm working through it.
Turned into 50-year-old angst, I think.
Well, I that's the thing, though. You never escape the angst. And I think that's one of the things we see in the diary. But going back to the politics side of things, you can't make it up. I mean, I think it's got to the point now where we're looking at world events and specifically UK Westminster focused stuff. And honestly, it's just got to the point where if Michael Dobbs had written this in the 80s, it'd have been laughed out of the place.
Well, I'm reminded of a famous Bushism. Do you remember George Bush and his...
Yeah.
The ability to stick his foot in.
Oh, yeah.
There was one that he said which was particularly hilarious, and it was along the lines of, our enemies never stop thinking about new ways of harming our country and our people, and neither do we.
Yes.
I understand what he meant by that, but you know, the way that he phrased it was utterly hilarious, but it reminds me of what's going on at the moment,
because I think
the rest of the world is I think looking at this and thinking, what the hell is going on in Great Britain?
Yeah, I think they are, and the fact is that we can know. I mean, it's interesting because we were discussing this with our author Tony Gartland yesterday, who is based in, as I was mentioning, these books. They're based in Malta, which is in itself a melting pot of warring sort of political factions, old families that have dominated politics there. But they're right in the middle of the Mediterranean, they're 200 miles from Libya, and it's an extraordinary sort of focus for a lot of dodgy money and all sorts of, you know, things being smuggled. And it's you know, and you think to yourself, oh, well, you know, that wouldn't happen in Britain. But actually, the fact is, we can no longer, as a country, look down on anybody else.
No, we can't.
Well, political... you say that, but I have... So my wife's in-laws are visiting from India. They're visiting the UK for the first time, and I turned the TV on and they saw this political show that's going on at the moment. And they just shrugged. They said, yeah, that's all in a week's work in India. And I've lived there for 10 years. Sorry, so that's why I write books set in India. And I've seen what truly comical, farcical, corrupt and otherwise lamentable politics looks like. So for me, this is not really as low as it can possibly get. There's a wonderful case of an Indian chief minister of a state, and the state is 200 million people in India, so it's three times the size of the UK. And he was given $1 million worth of funding for to feed the cattle, because it was a largely farming region. And he stole pretty much all of it. And he was never taken to task. And that's the sort of thing that people get away with in India. So I think in those terms, our politicians are relatively well-behaved.
Yeah, there isn't the financial mendacity to that extent in British system.
Not in a brazen
well,
sense.
I mean, you know, there are still enough checks and balances to stop that from happening. But, well, that's the theory anyway. But it's but then again, you know, some of them don't need the money, do they? Like Rishi Sunak or Nadeem Sahawi. I mean, they're all multi-millionaires married to billionaire daughters and stuff like that. And it's just extraordinary. So there you go. Anyway, we'll get back
where's
to
my billionaire daughter? Can you show
that? There you go. Yeah, and I had five boys. I don't think any of them are going to be billionaires, but or we have five boys between us, I should say. We need to get back to that sort of journey then. I mean, one of the things that I when I was researching ahead of this interview was something that you recorded on video about authenticity as an author, and how, in a sense, you've gone through that journey yourself, because obviously you have Indian heritage, but you're born in London. So going back to India for those 10 years has allowed you to write authentically about, you know, your country, you know, India. Is that a fair description? Yeah, or?
Very much so. I mean, authenticity, as you know, is a huge buzzword in the in the publishing arts, but the creative arts in general at the moment, with cultural appropriation being a big no-no and setting off tripwires and people existing in this climate of fear of saying the wrong thing or writing the wrong thing or acting the wrong thing even these days. I try to write books with mainly white characters because I'd grown up in the UK and I didn't see any books on the shelves that had any Asian characters, frankly speaking. The odd literary tome, but not commercial fiction, genre fiction. And it wasn't until I went to India and I lived there for a decade and I saw this amazing country going through these incredible changes of being a largely pre-industrial economy to the near global superpower that we think of India as today, with the shopping malls and the call centers, of which we've all been the beneficiaries, I'm sure, and all the rest of it. But also having these amazing legacy problems, poverty on a scale we can't imagine, and caste prejudice and religious intolerance and all the rest of it. And I thought, you know what, I've got to showcase this in a book, but I can do it in a way that possibly other authors haven't been able to do it, because you've got either Indians writing about India and the tendency is to gloss over some of the darker things, or you've got Westerners coming in and writing about India and the tendency is to go turn it all into a little bit Slumdog Millionaire and Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, where everything's charming and even the beggars are smiley and happy and win the lottery and live happily ever after. Well, that's not true. If you live in a slum in India, your life is awful and it is relentlessly awful. Probably a bit like being in Boris Johnson's cabinet was. Like, you are exploited, you are ruthlessly, the victims of abuse and the rest of it. And it's a hard, hard life. So for me to try and put all of those, that's one of my main impetuses for writing these novels. Exploring modern India and then going back in time with my second series, the Malabar House series, to look at the roots of this modern India. Where did this modern India come from? And although India is an incredibly ancient society, thousands of years old, it's that period just after India became independent where I personally feel that this modern India was established.
Absolutely. And, in terms of taking yourself into that period, how difficult was that to, you know, how much research does that take and how much?
Or do you have a time machine?
And because I've heard Abid talk about this, you know, in terms of there's an oral tradition, really, that, you know, your parents and your grandparents, you know, generations will pass on lots of stories of what they experienced during partition. Was that the baseline for your work?
Absolutely. So just to set the scene, so Midnight at Malabar House, it opens in 1950, and the protagonist, Persis, has just qualified as India's first female police inspector. And nobody knows what to do with her, though, so they stick her in Bombay's smallest police station, Malabar House, where the murder of a senior English diplomat living in Bombay happens, and it drops into her lap, and then she has to solve. But she's operating in an environment that is incredibly patriarchal, misogynistic. She's the only woman on the police force. Nobody wants to really work with her. She's paired with an Englishman, Archie Blackfinch, who's an Englishman who's come over from the Met Police to help set up a forensic science lab in Bombay. And what we've got here is two different sensibilities. So I'm sure you've heard of the saying, and some of your listeners, the sun never sets on the British Empire.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Gandhi once quipped that the reason for that is because God doesn't trust the British in the dark. what he meant by that was that even after the British left in 1947, because they'd been there for 300 years and because they'd kept Indians out of the senior echelons of the Indian civil service, which was the instrument of running the country, the massive monolithic bureaucracy, it meant that it took a while for Indians to get the hang of what to do with the world's largest democracy, as India then became. It was 300 million Indians at the time, and there's 1.5 billion now, so you can see how busy they've been over the last 75 odd years. And for me, it was important to showcase that environment because it's just a few years after Gandhi's assassination and partition, as you mentioned, when the country was divided up into three and a million Indians died, not at the hands of the British, I should say, although some might say
they were each other, yeah.
Because they killed each other, Muslims versus Hindus and Sikhs, often people who'd been living in the same village for hundreds of years together as neighbors. But that's what the inflammation of religious hatred can do to communities. It can tear them apart to the point where they will go out with sword and flame, torch villages to the ground, and cut each other up on trains and in the streets. And it was an absolute bloodletting, the like of which India had never seen previously, and the shadow of which still lies over the country.
Yeah, I mean, there is that, you know, those scars don't even scab over sometimes, do they? Because, you know, there are eruptions of this, some of it politically motivated and driven. You know, you think of Indira Gandhi and how she treated the, you know, the things in Amritsar or something like that. And indeed, you know, there are still terrible tensions between Pakistan and India, which are on the point of nuclear conflict every sort of 5 years, it seems. It just goes on, doesn't it?
Yeah, except that none of the nuclear weapons in Pakistan work, which doesn't surprise me.
Well, yeah. I mean,
probably press the button and it'll fizzle out and plop about 5 meters.
That sparkler, when you have a sparkler, it doesn't quite light.
That's slightly reassuring, but at the same time, I mean, what I hadn't appreciated, actually, I mean, this is something that really struck me as extraordinary, and I can't remember the exact details, but only a few months ago, the Chinese and the Indian army were fighting on the border with clubs with nails through them.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, we talk about India and Pakistan being a potential flashpoint, but actually the Chinese and the Indians are actually killing each other.
It's a very complicated geopolitical region for many reasons. And part of that is to do with the fact that India is now nearly a global superpower. China is a global superpower. And then you've got little old Pakistan on the side there who wants to believe that it's a global superpower. But it isn't quite. And you know, this is bearing in mind that my mom was born in Pakistan and raised there. And I have lots of friends there. And I have, you know, the utmost respect for the nation as a whole. It's just that the politics of the country have not lent themselves to creating a strong, viable democracy. Former cricketer Imran Khan is now trying to do that. But then, as we've seen, he's just been ousted from power. So it's a real old... It's a real mess. And that's why I say that when I look at British politics, it still looks reasonably sensible in comparison.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've been watching that the sort of progress or lack of it for Imran Khan, but also the fact that, you know, he has had to switch directions in terms of the basis of his politics so many times to retain power. And become a sort of almost a fundamentalist Islamist. at one stage.
Precisely. It's a very complicated setup there, and I just don't know what the answer might be. But I think for me personally, it's when I'm writing these books, what I'm really focusing on is the relationship between the Brits and people from the subcontinent, because as I said, 300 years is a long time. And, you know, some have described it as a bit of an abusive marriage, because the Brits did do many things that were not very good in India. And some argue that, you know, they also helped to bring progress to India in certain ways. I mean, not everybody would agree with that assertion. People talk about the railways.
Yes, I was going to say, what have they done for us? Yeah,
the railways is always a winner, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, you might not get many Indians agreeing that the railways were built for their benefit. But, you know, some people look at them now and say, well, they did help push the country forward. Others talk about the legal system or the educational system. A lot of the outsourcing is now based on the fact that English is a second language virtually around the entire country. And without that, they probably wouldn't have had this outsourcing bonanza. So you can argue the toss both ways. But for me, it's, you know, you think about, for me, when I write the Malabar House series in particular, and I do the research, which you asked about earlier, and I come across these amazing nuggets of information. And I think, you know what, that's got to go into the book. Because the backdrop to these books is about telling people what life was like in the Raj for Indians, not just for Brits, but then what was it like afterwards? And so, for instance, one of the things I discovered, which ended up in the most recent book, which is The Lost Man of Bombay, and that's coming out in August. So I discovered that Mount Everest, the person who it's named after, George Everett, Everest, a Welshman who was in India as a surveyor.
Yeah.
He'd never been to Everest, never set foot on the nothing to do with even identifying that it was the world's tallest mountain. That was done by an Indian named Sikdar. He identified, he was a mathematician who used trigonometry or something to identify that it was the world's tallest mountain. But the Royal Geographical Survey decided that, you know, this mountain needed a name, forgetting the fact that the Indians had plenty of names for it. And so they said, well, who can we name it after? Well, certainly we're going to name it after an Indian. So they, in the end, they decided to give the honor to someone who was very well respected, and that's George Everest.
We should get it renamed then, shouldn't we?
maybe.
Well, I'm sure there's a campaign.
I love the fact to use trigonometry.
But having said that, you know, Everest is split between, well, I mean, a couple of countries can claim it. Right. So I think there'd be a massive argument about who actually gets the benefit.
Mount Hobeck. There you go.
Yeah, Mount Hobeck. Yeah, I think that's got to be. I got very excited yesterday. This is a diversion in my head, but that's the way my brain works. When I found out that there's an Australian Navy ship called the Hobart.
Hobarts get everywhere. Though,
well, I appreciate, you know, it's going to be named after the place.
Is it dishwasher?
It's a kitchen equipment. The biggest kitchen equipment supplier in the world is Hobart. Yeah,
and they're American. Australian man who.
Yeah, but I just got very excited that there's a modern.
Is there a meaning to Hobart? Because Asian names normally have meanings.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Hard worker.
no, hard worker. Yeah, right. You know,
My name means Cosmic Prince of the Sun.
Oh, I like that.
Well, something like that anyway.
Yeah, well, you know.
Or maybe I just made that up, but yeah.
Well, if you translate my name into Japanese, so I taught English in Japan for 2 years, and their names tend to be probably a bit like what you said, that you could translate them into something. My name, if you translate it literally into Japanese, means Big Bell.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm not sure how you feel about that, but I think that's quite cheerful. It's very deep south.
Yeah, I mean, that would explain your bubble butt.
No,
I'm joking.
Bubble butt?
Oh, it's what how would we describe, it's Kim Kardashian's got the world's most famous bubble butt, as you know.
As in big?
Yeah, you could rest a pint.
Have you seen it? Mine's tiny.
I know it is. It's I was just joking. It was just throwing in, you know.
I wasn't going there. I was thinking of one of these wonderful bells who
Southern Bell,
they're a Southern Bell, that's, there you go.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well,
I think your name is better than mine though.
I'm so sorry to drag it down like that, but there we go.
I think we need to get our feet out of our mouths and carry on.
Yeah, okay. I'm trying to think of something cogent and intelligent to ask. But in terms of your, this is, you know, a standard question that you always get in a literary podcast, but this is what people hang on for. So they always want to know what your writing regime is. You know, what, how many words a day do you target?
Are you a morning person, a night person?
Oh, regime. Oh, gosh, makes it sound so professional or even fascistic. I'm an incredibly organized person, and I have to be because I waste most of my summer playing cricket on the weekends. So what I do is I tend to plan very rigorously for about 4 months before I begin a book. I use a spreadsheet to plan out all the various scenes in the book and do all the research and add it in until I've got a really comprehensive long plan. And then I begin writing, and I always write in the morning when my brain still works for about 2 to 3 hours. I try and get 1,000 words a day done. And then the rest of the day, I can swan off and do whatever I like.
Cricket
or whatever it happens to be.
Well, it's interesting to say that, because, I mean, this is one of the great conundrums, isn't it? In the sense that if you've got a passion for cricket or indeed golf or something like that, it takes time. But it's non-negotiable, isn't it? And I mean, you know, if you love playing cricket, and I'm very jealous that you're of a similar age to me, but I'm a bit older, but you're still able to play.
The definition of play.
Well, you can fit in some whites, which I don't think they make any big enough for me, but there you go. Possibly Colin Milburn's cast-offs or something like that.
I can paint you white. Paint you white.
Yes, a bit of white face. Yeah, that'll go down really well under the current circumstances.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that would really work well.
No,
yeah.
I mean the whites on your clothing.
Oh, I see. Yeah, go with body paint. Yeah, that's going to look good, isn't
can
it?
Can you imagine you going out like that and people saying, well, he wasn't white enough, so he painted himself white on top? I mean, that's very politically correct, that is.
Yeah. Oh, God, we've really strayed here, haven't we? But anyway, no, I saw that you play for the Authors Cricket Club. I am desperate to join that. I'm not good enough to join it, but I'd love to. You know, if ever you need somebody to field at long leg, then I'm your man. As long as someone else can pick up the throw that gets halfway to the wicketkeeper and then, you know, get it to the stumps.
You just described half the team.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to put myself forward at some point. But your passion for cricket, I mean, that presumably is, well, it always is with people. I mean, lifelong, or did you come to it late?
No. It's like anything else in life that you fall in love with as a child, and then you turn out not to be very good at it, or at least not good enough to make a living at it. You keep it up as a hobby, and that's what it's always been for me—a hobby, an enjoyable way to spend time with friends and to try and get out into the sun and a lovely grassy field. For me, I think passion is the key word here, right? Because we write, we read because we're passionate about books, we're passionate about literature, and with anything else that we're passionate about, we do it regardless of the reward. So, you know, you talk about the fact that Midnight in Malabar House is up for an award next week. If I don't win, it's not a big deal. I'm going to shrug my shoulders, and it's not going to impact in the way that I feel about writing. And the same would happen if my books weren't selling, I would still carry on writing. And I think that's the only attitude you can have to things that you're passionate about.
Yeah, absolutely. Going back to the cricket for a moment.
Do you watch test matches like he does that go on for hours?
Absolutely. There is no other form of cricket as far as I'm concerned.
Me too.
My brother's also a big cricket fan. And so I've just been on holiday for a week with my mum, my sister, and my brother. We had cricket on all day.
Good people.
Yeah, it's the only way. It's the only way. I mean, you know, it brought me up in the 80s. You know, my summers were you know, I had nothing else to do. I had to watch the cricket. And then, God forbid, in those days where, you know, there'd be a rain delay and they just put the test card back on.
Oh, I see. And my sister would go, yay, no more cricket.
Well, I was lucky enough to be at Edgbaston last week watching the India final test. Oh, yeah. And it was just brilliant, and Headingley prior to that, and I'm going to Old Trafford for a day, but I'm with you. It's just the best.
It's like, you know, test cricket for it's like a novel. You've got time for things to happen and develop and percolate and changes and twists and turns to happen. Whereas, you know, this new short form of the game, it's, you know, it's fine for what it is, but it's a quick gulp. It's a short story. It's
a comic.
It's an espresso.
Another good one.
An espresso one. I was going to be a bit more charitable, but yeah, we know. We're both on the same page.
No, so now you've put it like that, though. It's made me think.
I think you'd love it. I've got you into darts, right? And now, do you see, that for me is the winter
form. The thing about test cricket is this. You take your laptop, you take a book, you take a picnic lunch, and you basically don't have to watch a single delivery if you don't want to. It's just there in the background. It's just the epitome of Englishness.
It is. It is.
Oh, absolutely. Maybe you could take me next time, then.
Well, we'll work on this. But no. It's a great thing. We must be approaching Rebecca's random question time. Should we give it the build up?
Before we do,
I mean, we ought to mention, and we dropped his name in a couple of times. So you do a wonderful podcast, the Red Hot Chili Writers.
I keep saying peppers. I don't know why, where that came from.
Well, I mean, I think the peppers came after the writers. So, I mean, that's with Abir Mukherjee. How would you describe that relationship? Because, I mean, it comes over so well on the podcast.
Yeah,
the pair of you are brilliant. But, you know, there's obviously a great relationship between the two of you.
Well, that's very nice of you to say.
Better relationship than we have.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, well, you're only married.
Yeah.
Look, exactly. Look, we're great friends. We were published, I think Abir was published just a year after I was. I went to see him when he was on the New Blood panel. Launch in London, where he completely ignored me, although he will deny it and pretends that I ignored him. Anyway, I put out the olive branch and I invited him for a drink afterwards. This must have been 8 years ago or so. And, you know, there's a great picture of us having that drink somewhere in a pub in London. And after that, we've just been the best of friends, and we've done so many events together. And because we write in similar kind of books, in the sense that we're both writing about India, we're both writing about subjects that are true to our heart, about India, the Raj, and the era after the Raj, and because we're both very laid back individuals and have a sense of humor and don't take ourselves too seriously, in the end we thought it would be a good idea to have a podcast. And it seems to have, you know, it's kind of you to say, but it does seem to have worked out really well. The great delight of it is that we get to interview some of the world's most famous crime writers and writers of other feathers when we get the urge to talk about something other than crime novels. And I'm sure you guys do the same, because you have a great dynamic as well. And you know that the payoff really isn't about listeners and the rest of it. A lot of it is just the sheer fun of doing these things.
It's so much fun. It's a highlight of my week, honestly. We've done two interviews this week and it's like Christmas.
Yeah, but this was the better one.
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. Of course, yeah. This is, you know, sorry.
They're all the better one.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Okay, Vaseem, we need to put you through this, the ringer here. I don't even know what's coming, but here is Rebecca's random question.
Well, before I ask the question, we asked the dinner table last night what we should ask you. And my youngest son, who's 12, came up with quite an intellectual, deep question, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
But then I thought of something completely
ephemeral,
shallow. So I'm going to ask my question instead of his question. My question is, what is your favourite purple food and why?
What?
Purple potatoes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I saw them on MasterChef once, and I'm addicted to MasterChef.
Me too.
I do love a good tatty. So, you know what? Potatoes are the staple of the diet of the poor.
But what would you do with that?
I grew up
to make it, you know, a cordon bleu thing.
Oh, gosh, I'd have to turn it into one of those. Have you ever seen chefs turn them into those flowers?
Oh, yeah. The knife skills coming
out.
That's really fancy.
I mean, I have no knife skills other than chopping off my own fingers whenever I try and cut something. But yes, if I had the knife skills, yes, that's what it would be. It would be a wonderful, wonderful flower potato made of a purple potato.
Oh, I love that.
So it would look like a purple flower, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the presentation.
See, mine is red cabbage. I love red cabbage.
You do. You're obsessed with
red. Red is not purple. I'm sorry. Red is
well,
not.
No, purple. You know, it is purple, though, isn't it?
No, it is purple, but it's called red cabbage, so I'm not letting you have that.
I love that. I love that we've had a challenge here.
Stewed plums.
Stewed plums. I'm not big on boiled fruit.
Oh, interesting.
What's your favourite really, purple food then?
Purple sprouting broccoli.
Oh, I hate broccoli.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're trying to do the rainbow on a plate, it kind of helps. Actually, artichokes.
Not purple.
No, but if you look at the leaves, there's a lot of purple in those.
Beetroot.
But it's funny, but my dad used to, I mean, we used to have a fabulous garden in Cambridge. It was a third of an acre, and my dad was cultivate most of it. And he used to grow artichokes, which I didn't realize at the time just how posh that was. But we ate them in completely the wrong way. He used to cook them whole, and then you used to get the petals off and try and eat some of it. It was so bitter. It was bizarre. But anyway, we also use asparagus is another one where it's mostly green, but you've got a lot of purple involved.
I think that is stretching there.
Believe it or not, we had an asparagus patch. We were so posh.
Oh, you are? Well, you
well no, we inherited
posh.
It. I mean, we bought this house and it came with an asparagus patch. It was amazing.
We were eating Pinder's crispy pancakes.
I know.
My house. Yeah,
the funny thing is, you've kept your figure and I just ballooned and I've eaten deep fried everything for the rest of my life. So there you go. I mean, I had a really good start in life and then just went.
Purple Mars bars.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, there's an idea.
Well, I'm up in Glasgow tomorrow.
Ketchup.
I'm looking forward to having. I'm going to have a deep fried Mars bar tomorrow.
Oh,
you can get them from next to the Glasgow Central Station.
I probably should mention, my publisher wouldn't forgive me if I didn't mention that my next book is coming out soon, which is The Lost Man of Bombay, and it's coming out in August. It's the third in the Malabar House series, available for pre-order, people, if you'd like to get your hands on it. And it's got the most fabulous cover of any of my books and one of the best covers of the year. And it's not me saying that, it's just a lot of people saying that. It's got this amazing cobra on the cover.
Yes. Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, you're quite right. And where else can people find you? Apart from the Red Hot Chili Writers, which you can get all good podcast platforms, where else can they find you online?
Well, my website, BasimKhan.com. In terms of where I physically am this year, it's easier to say where I'm not. I'm at most of the big festivals. I'm doing a lot of other events as well. It's one of those things where pandemic has kept us indoors, and now pandemic is over. It seems to be a summer of events, and more power to all of the events organizers.
And if you don't see Basim at a festival, you'll see him in the middle, no doubt knocking out a century. 4, 11, or indeed taking the gloves as you did quite recently as a wicketkeeper. How was that? I've got to ask you.
Well, yes, I was asked, which is the nicest way of phrasing it, to act as the wicketkeeper, which and I have to say I haven't done it for 15 years, so my knees had quite a bit to say about it.
Oh my god, yeah.
Why? What do you have to do with your knees?
Well, you basically, a wicketkeeper is basically in a crouch for 90% of the day, and having to fling yourself around, you know, trying to, yeah, I have massive respect for anyone who keeps wicket.
Hard bloody work in 30 degrees heat, I have to say.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely bet. Yeah, no worries.
You wouldn't be wearing a Doctor Who scarf then.
Well, yeah, true enough. Listen, it's been an absolute pleasure, Basim. Good luck with the next book. Good luck with the one that is, you know,
up for the award.
And we hope that next time we see you, you'll be clutching that beer barrel.
And we'll give you a Hobet mug when we see you.
Next week. So you get
two enthusiastic people run up to you with a mug. And that's us.
I will never drink out of anything else again.
He said it. It's recorded.
Richard Osman said the same thing. And I believe.
Yeah, but everyone knows he's a big liar.
You're a man of integrity. We know that. But it's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you so much for joining us on the Hopcast.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much.
Well, I knew I'd made a mistake. And there is a reason for this, because we released this week a book by Tony Gartland, writing as A.J. Aberford, in which Marsabar plays a big part, which is in Libya. But this is Midnight at Malabar House by Basim Khan, which is up for the award.
I think you can be forgiven for that.
Yeah, I keep getting that thing wrong. So, you know, it was a great interview. Thank you so much, Basim, for joining us. And we look forward to seeing you in...
We promised him a mug, I think, didn't we?
We did. We're going to be taking a few. We've got a few left. We've had them about 18 months now, I suppose. They're very popular.
Yeah, I love our mugs.
Yeah, we you know, they are our calling card. And if failing that, we've got the badges.
Failing that, we've just got our happy smiles.
We have. And I have a little extra thing that I am taking to Haunegut.
And what's that?
I have a bottle of Edradour whiskey, which is a sherry cask whiskey made in Pitlochry. And that's exactly where I was earlier this week. And I went to the local whiskey shop, which was very fine. And I said, look, I want a sherry cask whiskey because I know that Miss Abby Mukherjee likes a sherry cask whiskey.
Should I take up my orange flavoured whiskey? Would that go down well?
It's a really no. No. These are connoisseurs. So I should be taking that and trying to smuggle it into the grounds of the Old Swan Hotel and see if I can entice authors to have a wee dram with us. And I think that the effects could be wonderful on radio, on the podcast. So that's what I'm taking up. I've ordered, and they should be arriving today, something called Whiskey Stones. And these are pieces...
Oh, I gave my dad some of them for Christmas once.
Well, they're brilliant. So you freeze them.
Yeah.
And they, rather than, you know, putting ice in your drink, because I do like my whiskey with a little coldness to it, but the thing is the ice will melt and ruin the whiskey. But with whiskey stones, you can chill them without the thing melting.
No, they're very good. I knew about them.
Yeah, so they're arriving today. And so I'm thinking of everything to make this work.
I'm actually thinking of a little surprise, but I just need to... There's a couple of things I need to do first. So all I'm going to say is there may be a visual surprise at Haunegut.
Oh, my God. You're going to strip naked or something?
No, you're going to strip naked.
I probably will after a few whiskies. So that's for sure.
That's all I'm saying. It might not happen. I just a couple of things I need to check before I can make it happen, but there may be a visual surprise.
Wow.
You don't know anything about it, do you?
No, I don't. It's as random as one of your questions, no doubt. No, looking forward to that. Well, listen, I mean, we're going to be speaking to, hopefully we'll grab some of the great names that are going to be there, but it is a wonderful collection of the great and good in writing terms, in publishing terms.
The bad, the ugly.
Yeah, we're providing the ugly and some of our authors are providing the good.
We are providing the ugly.
I'm providing the bad and the ugly.
No.
You'll notice I shaved today just to make sure.
Oh, I just have a feel?
Yeah, go on.
Oh, he has. He's shaved. He's all smooth like a Gillette advert.
I look really rough after Scotland. I didn't. I've had a week's growth and it looked awful. So it's come off.
Should we call it rugged rather than awful?
No, dreadful. And I looked ugly. So enough of that. But anyway, we don't know who we're going to be speaking to. We don't know quite when the episodes will appear from Haunegut, but we will probably have a couple of episodes based from Haunegut. Make the most of our time at the festival.
Better get lots of batteries, haven't we?
Oh, yeah. I'm taking about 100 batteries because the recorder eats them like nobody's business. But nonetheless, we shall have a great time, we hope. And we hope you do too, as we bring you some of the sights and sounds and not the smells of Haunegut, which is basically...
What does Haunegut smell like?
Well, it smells like 4 a.m, it smells of people puking up.
No, we're not doing any of that.
No, it's a lovely, lovely event under a big, big marquee outside the hotel. And, you know, if you can get there's a premium on winning a seat and holding it for the rest of the time. So, and there'll also be this thing where the authors gather together in a huge circle, which gradually grows during the day, doesn't it? And it becomes difficult to break into it. But I think this year, because we know, a considerable number of those authors now are aware of us, that should be easier, or at least we should have more confidence.
Well, I don't know. It might mean they might hide from us. I think, there's those two coming with their microphones.
Here comes the random question. Well, we'll see. We'll see. We hope not. We think we're well established now in the community, so let's see how that works out. Well, thank you so much for joining us for this bonus episode, episode 81 of the Hobcast Book Show. Don't forget to go to our website, www.hobeck.net. to find out more about our authors, our books, our recent releases, our audio plans, all sorts of things going on. And, of course, we will be bringing you the next podcast very, very soon. But from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful and creative, well, frankly...
2 days.
2 or 3 days, yeah, absolutely. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.